customer experience is kind of like my favorite joke. And the two guys are on a trail run in the woods, and they're about 5 miles in. They see a bear, and the first guy, "Oh my God, it's a bear! We're gonna die!" And the bear sees them, and he starts to raise his claws. And the second guy starts, you know, tightening up his running shoes. And the first guy says, "What the hell's wrong with you? You can't outrun a bear." And the second guy says, "No, I just need to outrun you, right?" And that's pretty much where we are. I don't need you to be awesome. I need you to suck slightly less than everyone else.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
So the New York Times has called Peter Shankman a rock star who knows everything about social media and then some. He's a 5 times best-selling author, entrepreneur, and digital keynote speaker, focusing on customer service and the new and emerging customer and neuroatypical economy. He's got a few startup launches and exits under his belt. He's recognized worldwide for radically new ways of thinking about the customer experience, social media, PR, and a few other topics, including the neurodiverse economy. So I wanted to talk to him because his customer service and social media clients have included the likes of American Express, SAP, the U.S. Department of Defense, Walt Disney World, and many others. So when we wanted to cover customer service and what the customer experience of tomorrow might look like, I knew Peter was the one we had to speak with. Peter, welcome to Future Proof.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah, a lot of fun. Glad to do it.
So I wanted to ask you just kind of how you define yourself. You know, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Good question. So I started my career at America Online back in the 90s when AOL was the internet. Wound up doing a lot of PR, marketing, consulting, ran an agency, eventually sold it, eventually launched something called Help a Reporter Out or Harrow, which sort of changed how journalists and sources connect with each other and changed my life. That was acquired about 10 years ago. Ever since then, I've been consulting, speaking. I'm a corporate keynote speaker who used to travel up until about 6 months ago, traveled about 250,000 miles a year. That radically changed, obviously. I'm still keynoting, but I'm keynoting virtually on customer economy, on customer experience, on the neurodiverse economy, the premise that within 10 years, 25% of the workforce is going to be ADD, ADHD, autism spectrum, executive function. Doing a lot of that, having a lot of fun, consulting on customer experience. It is a weird time. You know, the biggest problem I'm having, I mean, I'm getting a lot more time with my daughter, which is awesome. And as a single dad, that's great. But the biggest problem I'm having is that what used to be, you know, a 45-minute keynote in Tokyo used to take 4 days. Get there, speak, get back. Now a 45-minute keynote in Tokyo takes about, well, you know, 45 minutes from my kitchen. And that's a little weird. So trying to get used to it and doing the best we can.
So I know that you've shared a lot of great stories about companies delivering stellar customer experiences. What's an example or two that have particularly stood out to you over the years?
I mean, just an example of something that happened this morning. So, you know, the biggest thing that has always brought customer experience to the forefront is the concept of empathy. The premise that we don't expect companies to treat us well. We don't expect good experiences. You know, we go to the airport, we expect to get the worst TSA line. We expect to be delayed for an hour trying to get to our gate. After that, by the time we get to our gate, they've probably given away our seat. Now we're sitting next to the bathroom. That's what we expect. So if we just have a flight that takes off on time, arrives on time, and doesn't crash into the side of a mountain, you know, we're pretty happy about that. And so if you look at sort of what's been going on with COVID and everything like that, airlines realize that they are so screwed anyway, they might as well try being nice. And so all of a sudden, you have just this morning, for instance, United blew everyone else away by announcing that they're no longer going to impose change fees on domestic flights for foreseeable future, which is incredible. You know, that was a $4 billion a year business for all the airlines, and they're just giving it away because they're realizing, okay, people are in trouble. We need to get those customers back. Let's see what we can do to be nice. So the premise of the nice company finishing first, you know, really, really focuses on that. You know, the thing about great customer experiences is that they don't need to be amazingly off the charts incredible. Considering where the bar is, you know, what customers expect, all you really need is for companies to, pardon the expression, suck slightly less than their competition, right? You know, the simple act of United doing that is going to guarantee that they're going to double their revenue in the next 6 months. Now, that's actually pretty easy to do considering what the revenue is, thanks to what we're going through. But still, that's a lot more than anyone else. And the other one's going to have to follow suit. Customer experience is kind of like my favorite joke. And the two guys are on a trail run in the woods, and they're about 5 miles in. They see a bear, and the first guy, "Oh my God, it's a bear! We're gonna die!" And the bear sees them, and he starts to raise his claws. And the second guy starts, you know, tightening up his running shoes. And the first guy says, "What the hell's wrong with you? You can't outrun a bear!" And the second guy says, "No, I just need to outrun you, right?" And that's pretty much where we are. I don't need you to be awesome. I need you to suck slightly less than everyone else. You know, I'm going through I'm refinancing my apartment right now because why not, right? There's the economy is perfect for that. It's been a 6-month process, right? And every week I check in, hey, and every week Wells Fargo asks for more information or this or that. And it's been 6 months, right? Now, to my mortgage broker's credit, he calls me all the time. Peter, just want to let you know, here's what's happening. Here's why this is delayed. Just the fact that he's doing that lets me know that there's hope, right? If that's where the bar is, the fact that it's not getting done, but I'm happy because I hear from him, we're doing okay, you know? So I just need you to suck a little bit less than everyone else.
So one thing that also strikes me is, you know, I recall there are one or two of these really great stories that you've told. Maybe it was over social media or recounted in a book. But Morton Steakhouse, right? Is that the, you know, where they met you with the steak? Or am I totally getting it wrong?
That is correct. I was at the airport. I jokingly tweeted, hey, Morton's, why don't you meet me with the porterhouse when I land? Ha ha ha. And they did. Now, here's the thing about that. You could argue that's a great customer service experience, which it was. I mean, it was incredible. But Morton's job isn't necessarily to bring me a steak at the airport. Their job isn't to bring anyone a steak at the airport. Their job is to give you an amazing experience when you go to Morton's Steakhouse, right? You know, to have your reservation on time, to give you a great meal. They brought me a steak at the airport. But if you go there for a reservation and you're, you know, your steak is undercooked or your drink is wrong, you have to wait a half an hour for your seat, you know, that kind of makes what they did for me even worse, because like, oh, great. You know, they take care of Shankman at the airport. No shit for me, right? I'm here, my steak's cold. So, you know, they don't need to deliver a steak at the airport. That was a great experience. What they need to do is make sure that everyone has a good experience when they go to Morton. And again, that's the question of, you know, being nice and smiling and making sure your reservation's on time, all that kind of stuff.
But how about, okay, so can companies still deliver those powerful customer experiences in the COVID era? Like, I'm thinking about the fact that that warm smile, you know, and what if you can't even see somebody's face, you know, like all of these.
I would suggest that now is the best time to do that more than ever, because right now everyone is so worried and so confused and so scared, right? That the simple act of saying, hey, just want to let you know, here's your table outside. By the way, we just sanitized it. You're good. Little tiny things. We don't need a lot, just a little tiny thing.
Do you think that there are any particular marketing and business trends that are becoming a little bit more dominant right now that might wind up becoming permanent after COVID's no longer with us?
I think the concept of remote everything, right? You know, I can order a refrigerator and show up with a truck and they'll just dump it in the back of the truck. I never have to talk to anyone, right? I could do the same thing with food. I could do the same thing with medicine, with medications, basically anything. The concept of having the 30,000-foot store, with the exception of places like the Midwest and, you know, where that's all you got, you know, you're seeing massive major brands leave New York City because they don't need to be here, right? The concept, look at who's winning these wars. The one thing I did, I don't do many smart things in my life, but the one smart thing I did when this whole thing started was I bought as much Amazon and Peloton stock as I could afford, and they've both blown up, right? So for someone like me who I like persons, I don't like people. There's a big difference there, right? I don't like being in a giant crowd of people where, you know, I have to make my way or wait online or whatever. I like speaking to a group. That's a different story. I'm on the stage talking to them. But we're seeing a lot of, that's coming in a lot more. So the premise of, you know, those law firms that have those 30,000 square foot offices with the 4-story fountain in the bit, there's no need, right? We're going to see a lot of that go away. Morgan Stanley, I think, just gave up 30,000 square feet in Manhattan. They just don't need it.
But you know, what's interesting also about that is, those, in some ways, those are the people who had a lot of square footage per employee, you know? So in some ways, I almost compare that to the WeWorks of the world, where, you know, you're, no matter what, 3 feet next to, you know, somebody else. And it's not their fault that all of a sudden that became an awful customer experience overnight.
But the premise is there's going to be no need for it, right? I've been living this way for years. I have an accountant that I've been working with for 21 years. I've met him in person twice. I have my lawyer, who maybe I see once a year. Right, we talk on email, we talk on the phone, whatever. Now, granted, we threw ourselves into this, right? With 6 months, in 3 months, we did what should have taken 20 years. But so, of course, there's going to be problems, but it's good because we're getting a much better feel for how this can actually work.
So, you mentioned the example of, you know, having an airline that all of a sudden increases or improves their service just to be a little bit better than everybody else, which then ups the ante essentially for the whole entire you know, industry to respond. I mean, are there any other companies you found that have figured out how to deliver strong customer experiences, given how different our world is at the moment?
You know, it's funny. I tend to harp on them because they do so many things well, and I'm a huge fan of Peloton. And you know, again, I own stock in them, but I love what they do. You know, the second that they realized the studios are gonna have to close down, they said, okay, we're gonna play the classes we have on demand for 4 days, and within 4 days, they pretty much set up all of their instructors with Pelotons and stereos and computers and systems and high-speed internet and everything so that people could start, the instructors could start teaching from home, which they did. And it saved them because now the instructors are back in the studio, and they're back in the studio by themselves, obviously. But, you know, you watch them listen, and people were saying, oh, my God, biking and running on the treadmill and the Peloton is the only thing we have keeping us sane. You can't go away. And they figured out a way to do it. You know, a lot of it is listening to your audience, asking them what they want. They'll tell you what they want, right? You just got to listen to them. And then once you do, understanding that any way you can give it to them is going to make them beloved, right? Peloton's a goddamn cult. Let's be honest. It's a cult, and I'm just as much of a member as anyone else. I haven't seen that level of brand loyalty since I worked in America Online, and people would show up at the main entrance and just take pictures at the front door. Right, because they all met in a chat room talking about 90210 or whatever, you know. So it's this premise that this cult following still very much exists, and Peloton knew that and didn't want to risk losing them even for just a week or 2 weeks or whatever. And so they adapted as quick as possible, and it worked really well in their favor.
Okay, now the counterpoint I'd say to that, or I always try to be devil's advocate. I've worked with a lot of executives over the years where they've said, well, you know, I'd love to invest in a bunch of different things that are going to help me with my customer retention, right? But they can't track the return on investment on it at nearly as well. It's not like performance marketing in that way. So how does a company build a strong customer service and strong CX in a way that you can track the ROI on it, or at least make the case that it needs to keep getting funded?
Well, first thing I would say is that you don't have to spend a lot of money. You know, you don't need to spend a ton of cash to get your customers happy, because again, the bar is so low. When you consider how low the bar is, right? I don't need you to be awesome. I don't need you to spend millions of dollars on the customer experience. I just need you to be slightly better. And that's as easy as a smile. That's as easy as telling me that everything's clean. That's as easy as telling me that here's what we've done to make things less worrisome. You know, I don't need you to start spending millions. You get the customers you want by being amazing currently to the customers you have, right? And so the simple act of going out and talking to them, listening to them, asking them what they need, asking them what they want, you'll find that they'll tell you. And 99.9% of the time, it's not about creating multi-billion dollar experiences. It's about doing small things better. Every time I get on a flight, which I used to go on a flight, I would bring a 2-pound bag of M&Ms, and I'd walk onto the plane and I'd give it to the lead flight attendant. And I'd say, excuse me, are you the lead? And, you know, the second they hear that, their first thought is, okay, what does this guy want? You know, he's a Karen. He's going to, I'd be like, they're like, yeah, I'm the lead. Okay, these are for you. You just have to share them with your coworkers. And then they'd go through the five stages of M&Ms disbelief, where they couldn't believe that, oh my God, he doesn't want, wait, what is he? This is awesome chocolate, right? And they'd go and they'd share it with all their employees. Well, I'm usually boarding first. And so by the time I get to my seat, other people start to board. All the flight attendants now know they have a 2-pound bag of M&Ms waiting for them. They're chocolate. They're happy. Now they're boarding 300 people, all with big smiles on their face, right? All the flight attendants now have 300 have smiles on their faces. I've just improved the flight for everyone on the plane. What does that do? What did it cost me? 12 bucks, 14 bucks to make everyone happy, right? And it's just a little bit better is all you need.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way to frame it. I think that one thing a lot of people are concerned about in the economy that we will most likely be in for a while is that everybody's going to be price sensitive. If everybody has less money, then everybody is going to be, you know, trying to perhaps buy cheaper options than they would have a year before. And if that's the case, then does that not put a little bit of pressure on customer service for where people look at this and say, okay, what can I do to cut the experience in order to cut the price, in order to keep the customer? Or, you know, do you feel free to totally reject that hypothesis?
Well, I just think that, you know, again, it's not, price is a factor, no question about it. But more importantly than price is this going to help me? Am I going to feel safe? Is this going to make me, is this better than the normal level of crap I'm expecting in the world, right? And it's not that hard to get it. You know, I don't need you to be awesome. You just suck slightly less. And the premise that, sure. I mean, there's always going to be the people who are going to go on Ryanair, right, and pay $30 and be treated like shit and you know, have to pay extra to use the bathroom and things like that. That's it. But the majority of people are going to look slightly above that. And slightly above that means I don't need you to be awesome, just a little bit better.
So, I think an important part of serving your customers is understanding them better in the first place. And as you mentioned, we're going to have a more neurodiverse set of people that the average brand is going to have to serve. So why do you think the average brand needs to be familiar with the topic of neurodiversity in the first place? Obviously, it's a thing that you educate people on.
Look, at the end of the day, it comes down to money, right? If you go into your, I worked with a fast food restaurant and a fast food chain, and they wanted to know how to reach more people, right? I mean, they've spent so much money making sure their doors are ADA compliant and that they have ramps and things like that. But what about people whose brains are different? And you walk into this fast food restaurant. I said, let's go to one of your restaurants. We walked in. There were 123 items on the menu, on a virtual scrolling menu that was digital, right? With advertisements that would throw into the middle of the commercial, in the middle of the menu every once in a while, flash. And I wanted to shoot myself in the head, right? I said, okay, guys, now let's walk down the street to In-N-Out Burger. Check that out. Hamburger, cheeseburger, fries, shake, done, right? If someone, you have someone who's neurodiverse, who's ADHD, who has a 2.7 second attention span, where are they going to go? Right. Again, it comes down to understanding your audience. The neurodiverse economy, if we're looking at 20 to 25% of that audience, that's a lot of money. Right. And there are little tiny things you can do to, I'm working with that brand to put in Easy Pay Station or Easy Pass Station, whatever I'm calling them. I haven't picked a name yet, but basically it's a menu, one specific menu that says the basics. Right. And it's exactly that. Hamburgers, cheeseburgers, fries, shit, whatever it is. But they'll know to look at that. Right. And wouldn't that make your life easier rather than sitting there and going, oh, my God, I could have lettuce or two buns or two rolls or, oh, my God, I'm not hungry anymore. Right. So you keep it simple.
Yeah, I like that. I can't help but think, so I believe we've got daughters around the same age. Mine is just turned 7.
Yeah,
So it got me thinking if, folks like you and I were growing up now, what expectations would we have of brands growing up? I mean, there are certain things that are just in my head because my first experiences with brands involved this, and this, right? So at what expectations will kids of their age have of the brands of tomorrow that folks like you and I didn't growing up?
Well, I think one of the key things for me is that back in the day, if you wanted to contact a brand, you had to write a letter, right? And you would hope that they would respond. And if they did, they'd usually send you like a form letter. Now, you can go online and you can connect with the brand in real time. And so I think that that's the first thing, the concept of being able to communicate with the brand and cause the brand a world of hurt, right? In just a few seconds. I remember my father had a problem with, he had a Movado watch and he said, Peter, I have a problem with Movado watch. They've had it for 6 weeks. They're trying to fix it. They've had it for 6 weeks. It's ridiculous. And so I tweeted him out. And within 3 hours, he had a phone call. Watch be ready next week. It's so much easier. So I think that brands need to be aware that kids growing up now are going to expect, if not immediate, then pretty damn close to immediate response.
Yeah, and to your point, somebody else, is very willing to jump in and fill that vacuum for the brand that isn't responding, especially when it's in a public sphere like Twitter. It's very easy for somebody else to notice that an interaction like that's happening and provide, a little bit better service and use that as an opportunity to take your customers.
Yeah. No question about it. At the end of the day, that's all you got. Treat them well or they're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I know that there's a lot that you've gotten right over the course of your career. And I think it's great that you've got the humility to be like, I've gotten one thing right, which is buying up Amazon and Peloton.
I've got a couple of things right, I think, but not a lot.
I'm a big believer in the fact that you can't get better unless you acknowledge where you've gone wrong in a few places. And that helps essentially make you a better futurist and predictor of future trends. So what's an example or two of something that you've gotten wrong? And how's that helped you make better calls in the future?
I thought Yelp would have been out of business by 2016. I did not think that, what does the mafia do when they go and they ask for shakedown? I didn't think that asking for shakedown and protection money is a good way to run a publicly traded company. And turns out I was wrong. But then again, in 2016, the past 3.5 years, our whole government has run on the concept of shakedowns and protection money. So, I guess I didn't call that one. I remember being on TV as a talking head on one of the news stations on election night. And there's one part, if you watch the tape, there's one part around 11 p.m. where I'm in the, you can see me in the background, and I'm just mouthing the words, you know, as I'm watching the news. And so, you know, I don't get it all right. I try, though. I try.
Yeah. And I feel like to have that certain sense of humility and acknowledging it is a huge opportunity for people to just have a better batting average in the future. So hats off for being able to do it to the extent that you do. And Peter, I feel like a lot of people will get a good deal out of this and thinking about the customer experiences and what they need to look like in the future. So this has been fantastic. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Thanks again to Peter for making the time. I really thought that this was really interesting. And I think, you know, it's always nice to talk to somebody who has been around the block and had a lot to add on a particular topic like customer experiences. If you like what you just heard, and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.